Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Conlon. How are you doing, Phil?
Oh, it's good afternoon, Phil.
And today is, what's the official title? Remembrance Day. And we've already had an event at City Hall.
Yes, our mayor was there.
I don't know where to put this. Can't we be protected from this? Some of these absurd things. I understand the formality that there's a rule that says he's got to be there. But suppose he was in jail. We'd get him out and bring him. And on his side of the equation, we understand that he's fighting for survival. Anything he can get himself to, where we all have to stand at attention while he wears a poppy and talks. I mean, he's going to take that. This is absurd. This is a sober occasion, and there is a lot to remember. There is a lot to think about. This is the most shocking thing that nations can do, is go to war with one another with horrible losses, and then they have to explain to themselves why they went and what happened, and respect for the poor devils who died and for those wounded and all the unfolding. So when you have an occasion like that, and you have a figure who has become, let us say, controversial, it is only a simple good taste to say, look, with prejudice toward none, let's have a deputy come, because, you know, this is a sober occasion, pardon the word sober. And so, to my mind, we're shown to be in a kind of perfect storm of political controversy in the city, from which we don't seem to be able to. It's like a nightmare, you know. And I'm sure I'm not the only one who's Ford showing up in my nightmares, you know. I say, why did I dream that? I mean, more sober types, and I mean that in a cleanest sense, need to say, let's calibrate this, and because there are other things that matter, and this kind of occasion today, for example, is one of those things. And let us have a meeting and decide how to do this so people will feel most comfortable and feel that we've accomplished something. And that brings to mind a matter on Friday morning, CIUT Friday morning, 9 a.m., and I highly recommend, great show with Lynn Slotkin on theater and Daniel Garber on the films, etc. We had John Barber as a guest, and John Barber is one of the city's smartest observers and writers. He cares passionately about the fate of our city, and has written so well and so thoughtfully over the years. We were very fortunate to have him, but he is suggesting, and it's just a thought here, that we do something about the Elections Act, because we have an election act that will not permit political partisan parties to be part of city politics. It does, and he says, number one, well, why do you have it? I mean, because if you have a society in which you can democratically decide things, how can you say you can't? You must not. Montreal had such an act, and they removed it, and they have what they call municipal politics and municipal parties. The main thing you get from the argument that he makes from municipal parties is that you have accountability. Parties put together the membership lists, and they organize the people who are going to work for those parties, and you understand what they stand for. They have principles. They have some variety of leadership. That's not to say that the occasional odd politician, and Toronto has a number of those, won't go overboard or sail away in his own boat or sail away in your boat. But, I mean, we understand that goes on. But there is some degree of accountability in that system. He makes an analogy with Montreal having municipal parties. And if, for example, we had that here now, there would be a larger body of people in a position to say, no, you got to go. Because you violated our municipal party commitment to the people. And therefore, you know, it's over. Of course, there is a sister city. And when I say sister city, New York has similar demographics to Toronto, very, very similar demographics in terms of percentage of the population born elsewhere and language groupings and all those things. And they have pure party politics. And they, of course, were able to elect Mr. de Blasio. And everybody at the moment across North America is everybody's envious of de Blasio, who seems to be sort of personifies what you're looking for, in a, you hope, in a municipal leader. But there, because we don't have that, we have politics by stealth, where you start with 30 or 40 names or 20 names, and then the game becomes which party does he actually belong to? And they're very good at hiding. Meanwhile, the parties are busy turning over their membership lists and their phone system and their money to certain people. I think John Barber's right, we'd be better served with municipal parties or just raw, turn it loose, you know, political parties. Why not? We all know that when Mr. Ford got in, the heir apparent to the NDP leadership was, putting it bluntly, smeared out of the campaign, which removed one-third of the electoral forces whose votes had to go somewhere. And they didn't turn up to be where the people who did in Mr. Giambrone, they didn't end up where they thought those votes were going to go. And we inherited this. At any rate, that's an argument for a municipal party. I think John Barber, I recommend you go. My apologies to Mr. Barber if I have misstated his views at all, because I'm just summarizing what I heard. But I do recommend you just put in John Barber in his discussion of our present crisis. He did say, of course, that there is no silver bullet that will solve everything. But I think many in the city at the moment are thinking maybe a stun dart would be sufficient. That there have been moments when we all thought, isn't there somebody with a dart gun that could just kind of, and we calm down and we start again. Anyway, that's back to the main issue today, which or point of the day. I'm bothered by the thing where the big word is put in front of us is remember. We could all remember, and it's like suddenly I'm in church, you know, like, Phil, it's time to remember. And I say, good, but I mean, what church am I in? I mean, are these, you know, who am I standing next to? And you just, Phil told me on the way before the program, there are people who want to remember by saying we should never have been in, for example, World War I, which was a absolute horror, which led to another little thing called World War II, which if you didn't think World War I was ugly enough, they had another one coming. And there are people who are themselves pacifists, that they have white, what do you call it?
The white poppies.
Red poppy, white poppy. Yeah. So we actually have a minister in the government who says that they shouldn't be allowed to do this, that they're traitors. What word does he use?
He said they were disrespectful to veterans and to the war.
Well, of course, nothing could be more absurd than to say that. I wonder who takes the votes of the dead, who canvasses them and knows what's on their minds, you know, a loved one. Let's say a 17-year-old farm boy from Saskatchewan who got mowed down along with 1,000 other guys one afternoon because he had a stupid officer who wanted to pick up a medal. You know, what was on his mind? Does the minister know that? You know, does he channel these things? Maybe he's like Mackenzie King. Maybe, you know, he's got a dog that tells him this. It could be. Mackenzie King, you know, he used to sneak out the back door of his house and go down the street where he met with people who could get in touch with his ancestors. By the way, that worked out better than this present minister. I don't think Mackenzie King would have said anything nearly as stupid as this or as insulting, particularly if you keep in mind that I believe they claimed that it was a fight for freedom. And freedom of speech, because that's what we all value so much. Therefore, people with white poppies are bad people, according to this guy. Anyway, I found a column from the Toronto Star that I want to share from years back. And this is written on December the 8th, 1923, by a Toronto Star reporter. He titled his piece, War Medals for Sale. And he was himself a veteran and had been wounded. So he thought he wanted to look into the medal question. He went to the right place to find out. Here's how the article goes. What is the market price of valor? In a metal and coin shop on Adelaide Street, the clerk said, "No, we don't buy them. There isn't any demand." "Do many men come in and sell metals?" I asked. "Oh, yes, they come in every day, but we don't buy metals from this war. "What do they bring in?" "Oh, Victory medals, mostly 1914 stars, a good many MMs, that's a military medal, and once in a while a DCM, which is, I'll look up the DCM, or an MC, military cross. We tell them to go over to the pawn shops where they can get their medals back if they get any money for it." So the reporter went up to Queen Street and walked west past the glittering windows of cheap rings, junk shops, two-bit barber shops, second-hand clothing stores, and street hawkers in search of the Valor Mart. Valor Mart. Inside the pawn shop, it was the same story. "No, we don't buy them," a young man with shiny hair said from behind a counter of unsigned pledges. "There's no market for them at all." "Oh, yes, they come in here with all sorts." "Yes, MCs. And I had a man in here the other day with a DSO. I send them over to the second-hand stores on York Street. They buy anything." "What would you give me for an MC?" asked the reporter. "I'm sorry, Mac. I can't handle it." Out onto Queen Street went the reporter and into the first second-hand shop he encountered. On the window was a sign, We buy and sell everything." The open door jangled a bell. A woman came in from the back of the shop. Around the corner were piled broken doorbells, alarm clocks, rusty carpenter's tools, old iron keys, cupies, crapshooters, dice, a broken guitar, and other things. "What do you want?" said the woman. "Got any metals to sell?" the reporter asked. "No, we don't keep those things." What do you want to do? Sell me things?" "Sure," said the reporter. "What do they give me for an MC, military cross?" "What's that?" asked the woman suspiciously, tucking her hands under her apron. "It's a medal," said the reporter. "It's a silver cross." "Real silver?" asked the woman. "I guess so," the reporter said. "Don't you know?" the woman said. "Ain't you got it with you?" "No," answered the reporter. "Well, you bring it in. If it's real silver, maybe I'll make you a nice offer on it," the woman said. "Say," she said, "it ain't one of them war medals, is it?" "Sort of," said the reporter. "Don't bother with it, then. Them things are no good." In succession, the reporter visited five more secondhand stores. None of them handled medals. No demand. In one store, the sign outside said, "We buy and sell everything of value. Highest prices paid." "What do you want to sell?" snapped the bearded man behind the counter. "Would you buy any war medals?" the reporter queried. "Listen, maybe those medals were all right in the war. I ain't saying they weren't, you understand. But with me, business is business. Why should I buy something I can't sell?" The merchant was being very gentle and explanatory. "What will you give me for that watch?" asked the reporter. The merchant examined it carefully, opened the case, looked in the works, turned it over in his hand, and listened to it. "It's got a good tick," suggested the reporter. "That watch now," said the heavily bearded merchant, judicially laying it down on the counter, "that watch now is worth maybe 60 cents. The reporter went on down York Street. There was a second-hand shop every door or so now. The reporter got to a price on his coat, another offer of 70 cents on his watch, and a handsome offer of 40 cents for his cigarette case. But no one wanted to buy or sell metals. "Every day they come in to sell those metals. You're the first one ever asked me about buying them for years," a junk dealer said. "Finally, in a dingy shop, the searcher found some metals for sale. The woman in charge brought them out from the cash till. They were a 1914, 1915 star, a general service medal, and a victory medal. All three were fresh and bright in the boxes they had arrived in. All bore the same name and number. They had belonged to a gunner in the Canadian battery, a Canadian battery. The reporter examined them. "How much are they?" he asked. "I only sell the whole lot," said the woman defensively. "What do you want for it?" "For the lot, $3. The reporter continued to examine the medals. They represented the honor and recognition his king had bestowed on a certain Canadian. The name of the Canadian was on the rim of each medal. "Don't worry about those names, mister," the woman said. "You could take them off, take off the names. Those would make a good you good medals." "I'm not sure these are what I'm looking for," the reporter said. "You won't make no mistake if you buy those medals, mister," urged the woman, fingering them. You wouldn't want no better medals than them." "No, I don't think they're what I want," the reporter demurred. "Well, you make me an offer on them." "No. Just make me an offer. Make an offer. Any offer you like." "No, not today." "Make me any kind of an offer. These are good medals. Look at them. Will you give me $1 for all the lot?" Outside the shop, the reporter looked in the window. You could evidently sell a broken alarm clock, but you couldn't sell an MC, Military Cross. You could dispose of a second-hand mouth organ, but there was no market for a DCM. You could sell your old military puttees, but you couldn't find a buyer for a 1914 star. So the market price of Valor remained undetermined. So that's a Toronto Star reporter named Ernest Hemingway. Pretty good observation. I'm sad to say. You notice how the woman said you could take the name off, and then you'd have something. So that's among the things we ought to remember, that in 1923, a young veteran, and by the way, he nearly had his leg blown off. The doctors told him they were going to take the leg off to save his life, and he decided to run a gamble to save it. And one of the reasons he almost lost it, the leg, was that being in a blast situation in 1918, he was with the ambulance corps. He was one of those people who was so stunned they don't know quite where they are. And there was a wounded friend of his, who was going to die if he wasn't saved. And he picked him up and carried him some distance, thereby almost finishing off his leg and almost finishing off his life. I would conclude from all that what we're supposed to be talking about with medals and memorials is our duty, which is to prevent war. Prevent it. This is not an argument between pacifism, and violence. It's an argument to obey international law. And so you want to remember something? Remember that Nuremberg said the supreme crime was starting a war. And since World War II, we have not had one of those, which people have to understand, because the word war is being thrown around rather loosely. Young men here volunteer to be part of what I could call an expeditionary force. They go to some other country and beat up on people or get beaten up on, and they come home, and everybody says they love them, and then they forget about them, and then they all have terrible wounds or terrible memories, and it turns out you don't get to be hero every day of the week, and you don't get the job that you thought you were going to get, and you have problems and all kinds of things. Well, that happens because you were near or something went off. But a war where a state, a major power, decides to violate law, that's when you get it all. You don't have to go to the war. It comes to you. And by the way, one of the problems Americans have a little difficulty grasping this, and to a degree Canadians, is that we didn't have armies marching up and down across us with modern weapons. I have a friend in Belgium who said, you know, I find it funny, I visit North America and I see these antique shops. He said, we don't have antique shops because everything was blown to pieces. He just wanted me to know that. He kept looking after me after he had said it as though, do you understand that? Do you hear me? And I said, I hear you. I get it. And we just missed a war, by the way, in the Middle East in September. Narrowly missed it. President of the United States was going to do it one more time with pleasure, except that he was told by major powers, don't do that. And there was a slight ripple through the world public saying, you can't be sure every time you race into a country under this new banner that you invented, and the Canadians helped you invent it, the R2P banner, which is you can go and save people you select to save. If somebody tells you don't, and the Security Council is the one to tell you, then you better look out, and all the rest of us better look out too. That's what we should remember. And the U.S. is the one that's been pulling on the leash established by Nuremberg and by the Security Council of the United Nations, which is a result of World War II. And when you talk, we talk about medals, and everybody says, oh, he's a hero. That, you know, and we're all peons, and they're marvelous. And make way for that one with the medals. Well, three very important leaders in post-World War I Europe promoted themselves on their medals. One of them was Mussolini, who had a bunch of medals. Another, we all know, the famous German, Hitler, with the little corporal. He had medals, and people say, oh, there he, by golly, he gave it all, you know. He laid it on the line. And there was a man, Dollfuss, in Austria, a highly decorated guy, by the way, quite brave. If you're an Austrian and you talk about the war, well, you know, Dollfuss, he didn't belong in the war. He was less than 5 feet tall, but he was a fighter. He was going to get in there. And so he did. We tend to, we're sort of ethnocentric when we talk about remember our side. Well, how dumb are we? Everybody has medals, and if people are going to run for office based on their medals or have a path cleared for them, no matter how pathological they might be, it's still quite a frightening phenomenon. American politics is full of it, Canadians less so, but that is, being in the war is the way you get elected, you know. Kerry thought they would elect him because he'd been in. McCain hoped they would elect him. By the way, Dwight Eisenhower was a walk-in as president because he was the Allied leader. A walk-in. How are you going to get in the way of this guy? By the way, just to show how bad old, I.F. Stone thought that if Eisenhower was elected, fascism was coming. That didn't turn out. But anyway. I raise this today because on the Syria matter, we're trying to get peace talks. There is a thing called Geneva II? Have I got the right country? State? Geneva II. Now these are talks, and the rules have been set by the major powers that have put the talks together, primarily Russia and the United States. So today, the Toronto Star tells me the rebels conditionally agree to peace talks. Well, let me translate for the Toronto Star. The rebels do not agree to peace talks because they are unconditional. You cannot put a condition. And they also don't say that the prime condition that they are putting on attending the peace talks is that Assad's got to go. Well, that's, of course, the position of Obama. But Obama was told, no, these talks don't say that. You cannot dictate who is going to run Syria. But because they are the ones that are now dragging the can, everybody sees it's them, it's these terrorists who are sponsored by the Gulf states and by France and by the United States, look bad because they don't want to be part of talks. So they now say, oh, yeah, we want to go, but on this condition. Well, the point is that they are actually trying to abort the talks because the talks are a no-condition talks. So you care about remembering, remember to not allow snakes like this to get away with these tricks. and the star be remembering on page one and then pulling a stunt like this inside the paper because they're on the side of people. By the way, they are killing people. If you want to remember the war and you don't want to kill anybody, then you say, well, let's have talks. And don't be passing weapons to these terrorists who are financed by absolute monarchs. We'll probably touch on a few more of these things. I got to make sure I say congratulations to Beth Satoon. They've been voted the best place to get new ideas in Toronto in a reader's poll taken by Now Magazine. I think that's just announcing it today. And good for them. It richly deserved. It's a great environment, Beth Satoon, which is behind. It's behind Onstead. It's easy to find. Just go to Onstead. It's behind Onstead. And tomorrow night, they are having it's a puppet show. By the way, Phil, you were going to pronounce the German name for me.
Okay, well, you'll come back to me in a minute, and I'll get back it up to and you. We'll...
But it's tomorrow night. Well, it is it's November the 12th, 8 to 9 p.m. Here's the title, the Seven-Person Chair Pyramid High Wire Act. So write that down. Go to betsatoon.org. And also, I want to remind everybody that RomaToronto.org is a great site, and we need to be very alert to what is happening to the Roma today around the world. As always, with economic hard times and national rivalries, a clampdown occurs against vulnerable minorities. One of the oldest populations, an essential part of Europe, the Roma people are catching a lot of grief. You should go to the Roma site, RomaToronto.org. A speaker is coming to town. His name is Ben White. He's a British author. He's lecturing on articles in the theme of Israel, apartheid, not democracy. This is a descriptive position. He is going to be at. By the way, he's Ben White. Ben White, one word. org.uk, and he's going to be at York University 19th of November at 6:30. He's going to be at the University of Toronto 20th November at 5 p.m. That's the Scarborough campus at 5 p.m. on November the 20th. He's going to be at Ryerson 21st of November at 6 p.m. He's going to be at University of Western Ontario November the 22nd. I love being in the internet period because we can say benwhite.org.uk, you got it. He'll tell you where he's going to be, and you can even see clips of him. He's auditioning for you. Yes, Phil, can you pronounce
that
word?
We're gonna say the German word. It's the Der Vorführeffekt Theater, which I think means the leading effect theater, the Seven-Person Chair Pyramid High Wire Act.
Okay.
So there you go. That's tomorrow night at Beth Satoon.
Well, you did a lot better on that than I would have.
Everybody should read what Mark Twain had to say about the German language. It's very funny.
Yes. Don't get us in trouble with but we'll try to read that on the air someday. We'll have to bleep some parts. And Glenn Ford is coming to town on Saturday, 16 November. He's going to be at OISE, University of Toronto, 252 Bloor Street West, room 2. And then it's 2:14. I think that's second floor. And that's going to be the afternoon of the 16th of November. Glenn has been a guest on our show many times. We certainly appreciate his contributions. And that is the sponsors is the socialistaction.ca if you want more information. And coming up, we have, and I forgot to announce it off the top, it's Keith Bollender, who's written a great book, Cuba Under Siege. We're going to talk up to Keith about his recent speaking tour together with other Canadian authors. So we'll take a break and we'll be back with Keith Bollender.